Now, I think then we had our religious marriage in Berlin, of course, where Ilse was at home and her family was there in the studio of a rabbi who then later came to America too. And Ilse said before, I'm sure I will, what do you say, if something, you have a glass and you
tip it over.
I tip over that glass or swallow in the wrong thing when I have to. You have to drink a sip of wine, I think. It's a little long ago. and that happened too. So, and then we had a very nice celebration in the house of an aunt of her who had a tremendous big apartment yet. We were the two only ones who had drank apple wine. Apple juice, the others had champagne. We weren't, even at that time, not interested in champagne. Not in order not to become sober, because by that time, as they say in the Jewish scriptures, we already knew each other. We weren't quite from Dumsdorf. after all, we were a civilian. Our civil marriage was a week before, so it was legal. Now, one thing I remember, one of the very nice aunts came and said, well, Vorfreude ist die schönste Freude. That's how do I translate that?
Joy ahead of time.
Anticipating joy is the greatest joy. She says that on our marriage day. But we fooled her. We still love each other. Oh. And she's already playing the harp. Okay.
Without an orchestra.
Yeah. Job setting
and
up.
One other thing that, yeah. And then we're going. I'm going to speed this thing up because I
yeah,
know you're
we
anxious
have
to. I'd like to put one thing in here. What are your brothers are in the United States? One lives in Pittsburgh.
One lives in Pittsburgh.
And one in California.
And one in Los Angeles. Yes.
And the one in Los Angeles is in.
He's the oldest brother. He is an. You mean what he does
yes.
for a living? As
yes.
one says. He is a personnel chief in some factory.
And he's married and he has children.
He's married and has one daughter who has already a grandchild.
And your brother here is married?
Brother, he is married and has no children.
No children, okay. So now we're in the United States, right?
Yeah, then we got the affidavit, thank God, and came over and we are in the United States. We were received by the... was it Hyers?
I think. It sounds like Hyers, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And those poor people were so overrun. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of refugees came, and the German refugees. You know, we never felt as a race. We were a German Jewish religion, but it showed us another way. We were just as arrogant as a non-Jewish German. You know, nobody wanted to stay. We wanted to be treated like we were treated over there. And then they all were big shots over there. Everybody was a director, a general director. Nobody was a clerk or a salesman. That's the famous story with the Dachshund. You know, two German met in the Vierten Reich in the Upper Broadway. They say, you have a little nice little dog there. Oh, he used to be a St. Bernard's over there.
And that's a little dachshund, isn't
it? You know, that's why I told nobody when I came to America that I was a conductor. Because they would have thought, oh, sure, conductor. I told them I was a musician. That was all I told them. And I didn't even try out to get a conductor position. I know I wouldn't get it. Because I couldn't say that now, but what I know about my profession, how you get into it most of the time. I just practiced 6-8 hours viola and auditioned. So
you came to New York.
Came to New York. And they asked us, what can you do and so on. So we told them, and you want to stay in New York? Say, not necessarily. We lived with my second cousin in New Rochelle. That was the first thing. We went later to the Hyers. And they took us up in their home. And I was very lucky, because one day he came home and said, "Listen, Richard, the Harthouse Quartet is here." Harthouse was a string quartet based in Toronto and called after the Harthouse, whatever that is in Toronto. Toronto, to say here. They arrived without a viola player because the wife of the viola player, come in, Marty. You're an angel. Thank you.
You are now in Rochelle, and you had the opportunity to...
The Harthouse Quartet. The viola player didn't come along because his wife caught typhus in London, and he stayed with his wife. So he was looking for a viola player. He tried to get Primrose, but Primrose was the principal viola with NBC, with Toscanini, and it wasn't released. So he told him, I told you that my second cousin who brought us over was a music fan, or nar. So he knew a lot of music, since he was very well to do. He had a factory here. He entertained a lot of artists, and they played quartet in his house, European fashion. And occasionally he invited the artists to play with them. So he knew this Mr. Levy, who was the primarius, the first violin of the quartet, intimately. And he said, "Well, I have a second cousin here from Europe. He plays viola. I don't know how. Why don't you listen to him?" So he told me, he said, "Come down to the Hotel Sevilla," which at that time existed on 58th Street, I think. "And meet Mr. Levy and take your viola along." And I went down and played for him. And he said, "Fine, would you mind coming tomorrow again and play with us three, some quartet?" I did that, and they engaged me for, they had a tour booked, which they had to start. This was in December or end of November, probably December. We arrived on the 11th of November, so it was somewhere in December. And they engaged me for that tour, which was, of course, a miracle for me. It started on the 1st of January. No, on the 2nd of January, or 3rd of January. We left on the 1st of January, New York, in a Pullman train for Austin, Texas. Now that was really the new world for me, Pullman train. I never was in a sleeping train over there, not to speak of the Pullman trains with the lounge and the radio and all those things and the bar. Everything was incredible for me. Then there was a radio on, and then they laughed and laughed, and I couldn't understand a single word, not one word, because I spoke that school English. You know, with Bert and Mutch and all that nonsense they teach you over there.
You learn the King's English.
And here they speak, and you don't understand a word. So, finally, I found out there was Charlie McCarthy on the. I don't know whether you still remember Charlie
McCarthy.
I sure
do, and Edgar Bergen.
Yeah. Certainly. So there was, and they all left. So we finally landed, or rather arrived in Austin. And when we walked to the hotel, the people looked at us as we were nuts, because we had our heavy winter coats from snow in New York, and there was sunshine. So we went to the hotel and threw our coats on the beds and went out. We played in the university, so they came and picked us up and drove us around, and I saw live cactus of this size. I never saw a live cactus in my life. This was all incredible for me. Then we had our first concert. And then we started a tour from city to city, small cities, big cities, up to New Hampshire. But two things I never forget. After each concert, there was a reception in some lady's home. And we were introduced, the artists. And then it was told that they all play Stradivari instruments. Which was absolutely not true. None of us had a Stradivari instrument. They borrowed a very good Italian instrument for me in New York, because my German viola wasn't good enough. We all had Italian instruments, but none a Stradivari. But if we would say Guillaume or Guarneri, he explained to me, the people would know what that is. It might be something like lasagna. So they say Stradivari. That's the only thing they know that was an instrument.
And a good one.
And a good one. And that raised the respect for the players. Well, if they play Stradivari, they must be good. So that was one thing. The other thing was, of which I was almost afraid, oh yeah, then I had to learn, they never said, they always said nice things to you. I enjoyed the concert. Then your viola sounds very good. Then they told me you have to say thank you. I then learned to say thank you. But you don't do that in Europe. You say, oh, I'm glad you like it or something, or don't say anything. Modestly, you be quiet. Then I say, now when they say to me, your viola sounds good, and I say thank you, do I have to make a bow with my viola too? Or can I speak in the name of my viola? So then we went, no, naturally, from hotel to hotel, and always in the morning when we were at breakfast in those famous, in the coffee shop in the niche, you know, how do you call it? The cubby hole?
The booth.
Booth. The reporters came. And as soon as I saw the reporters, I packed my mouth full with food, so I couldn't speak. And kept eating and eating and eating because I couldn't understand a word they say. I was deadly afraid they would ask me a question. So I let the others speak. Then later I said, excuse me, Mr. Levy, but I can't understand them. See, my dear fellow, I can neither.
They were Texans that were interviewing you, weren't
they? Yeah, of course. And then we went north and so on, and we ended in New Hampshire.
I would like to know now.
Yeah.
Then how quickly did you come to Pittsburgh?
How quickly? We arrived Armistice Day. At that time it was called Armistice Day, 1937. And we arrived in Pittsburgh on Ilse's birthday, May 1838. And this was through Hyers. And when we came to Pittsburgh, he was sent to the Federation, in which your mother was very busy, Mrs. Sober. Lieber.
That was
Sober is the rabbi, the new rabbi of Temple Emmanuel. Sorry.
Ruthie's mother was Mrs.
Weinhaus.
Mrs. Solon Weinthal.
I remember her very well because she was so, but she was so nice to us. We were often in your house.
Right.
We ate on that porch. Out there you had so many people, a big banquet, and we were sitting modestly back.
And the Weinthals brought us over.
And I know that your mother was very active in Jewish affairs. So we met the legendary Zina Saul. That was one of the most angelic women. If there was one, it was Zina Saul. Saul, how do you pronounce
Saul.
It?
Saul.
Saul.
Saul. Zina was an angel.
And who was she associated with?
She was
Federation.
She was the head of the
Jewish family.
Yeah, of the immigration office of the Federation.
My mother knew them.
You know?
Her.
So.
Her name
is Street. Right. So everybody had to come to her and to be interviewed by her. And she says, "Where are you? We are waiting for you." Now, after the hires in New York, they just threw you out. And I didn't blame them, because they were so overrun. Somebody should be waiting for us. We were touched. And she was so sweet. And they said, she had some Russian accent. "Mr. Karp, what can you do?" I say, anything. She said, "Anything? Can you make shoes?" They know that I can make. "See, you cannot do anything." So now tell me what you really can do. So she was a wonderful woman. And then we were often in her house. And she got us in, you know, with Anna Perlow in the settlement. And the late Mrs. She was a pianist for Harvey Gall at the Y Chorale. Wonderful lady. So in other words, she got musical connections for us. It wasn't a French connection, it was Zina Saul connection. She knew everybody and worked for us as we would be her own family. Incredible woman.
Where did you move? Where did you move in Pittsburgh?
Wait a minute, I have to tell you one thing. Why I came to Pittsburgh. While we were in New York, I tried to audition everywhere. And I don't want to get in the sad story that I won auditions and didn't get the job because the contractor was paid under the table. Now, I can prove it. It's not sour grapes. But then, finally, I got two real offers. Rainer came to New York. No, Ilse wrote to Klemperer. Klemperer, she was in the Philharmonic Choir Otto Klemperer, yeah, the famous Klemperer. She was in the Philharmonic Choir in Berlin under Otto Klemperer. And he at that time had the Los Angeles Philharmonic. And she wrote to him and explained who she was and thought whether he had an opening in the orchestra. And he wrote a very nice letter to us, which Ilse still has, saying, "No, but my colleague Rainer is starting a new orchestra or building up the symphony orchestra in Pittsburgh. There might be openings. Why don't you go in touch with him?" In fact, Klemperer was here the first season to start it for Rainer. So we got in touch with Rainer, and I got an invitation for an audition at Carnegie Hall. Don't know how they call it, Carnegie Chamber Hall. And I played for Rainer. I didn't tell him anything about my intimate friendship with him without his knowing. I told him that later. No, I just came in as one of the ones who were called to audition. And he gave me things which nobody can play for sight reading. Josef's Legende by Richard Strauss. You know, most people don't even know it by name. You play as a player there and things like this. And I was a very timid guy. I still am, believe it or not. But then I said, "Mr. Hein, I don't think this is for sight reading." He says, "No, but I want to know how you do it." And then he gave me other things, and then he gave me the contract. But he says, "You have to be in Pittsburgh in order to..." Well, I went to Pittsburgh this way. So that's why. At the same time, I had an offer as principal viola player for Indianapolis. Now, instead of going to Indianapolis, I think I go really rather second desk with Fritz Rainer, whom I adored anyway, musically. So this way we came to Pittsburgh. But we came on the 18th of May, and the symphony started in September.
All right, oh sure.
Oh. So naturally we had to do something until our first symphony check came in. And we did everything. Jewish community was terrific to us. We were invited, for instance, I can't only remember the name, by people to play, not to exploit us, to entertain them, but to meet other people, like they invited Theodor Spitalny to come over.
Spitalny, yeah.
You know, who then had radio orchestras. And so on, and he engaged me for one. And to meet Harvey Gaul, we sang in his choir, in order to meet other musicians or people or organizations who would hire us to play for them or something like that.
Do you remember the names of any of the organizations?
The one I remember, but they didn't pay us till today, so I don't want to mention it. I sometimes like to send them a bill for $10 plus interest going back to the year 1939. Generally, everyone was wonderful to us. We got seats for the holidays at B'nai Israel and Cantor Blum, you know, whose son is a very famous musician now, the oboe. Blum.
Plays the oboe.
Yeah, his son.
Yes.
Invited us and so on. We came to know a lot of people. I got those weekly jobs at KDKA, which helped us naturally a great deal. In fact, We practically lived, right? Poor Ilse baked cookies and we peddled them. But we didn't feel like as martyr. We were very happy. We were very happy to be here and be human beings again. You don't know what it means to for years to live in a country where you are not human beings, where you are just could be picked up any moment and just eliminated. I mean, nobody can imagine what that is. So we didn't feel as victims at all. I remember the first time we went for a walk in New Rochelle and looked at the sky and say, look, nobody bothers us, nobody looks at us, nobody cares whether we are Jews or not Jews. We live as human beings here. It is incredible. We were very, very grateful, and not one moment did we feel, oh, we poor people, what happened to us? Not one moment. Now, let's go on. Job setting up house. This was my first job, the Pittsburgh Symphony.
And where did you live?
We lived in the South Atlantic Avenue.
South Atlantic Avenue?
Yeah.
In a rooming house? Or?
Sort of a rooming house. We rented one furnished room in the attic.
And did the Federation or Mrs. Saul help you get this?
No, they just say, look in that section, there are some trees and so on, you know.
What rent did you pay?
Oh, I have no idea.
How
could I remember that? Maybe Ilse does, I don't know. We went from house to house. I remember at one house, first we thought there was always room for light housekeeping. And we thought, how unethical. How they exploit the people. They have to do housekeeping in order to get a room. We didn't understand what it meant. Then I came up and said, you have a room for rent? We don't rent to foreigners. Peng! Closed the door. I say, are you Indian? But those were non-Jews. They probably didn't want to rent to Jews. But then we went to one house there and say, yes, I have a room for rent. Come upstairs. I show it to you. I say, I think we can speak German to each other. How do you know? So that was a very sweet lady, Miss Wurster, where we rented an attic room. And later we had a few things, very few, but books and so, and music that came in boxes. And when the boxes came, we had a choice. Either the boxes go into the room or we go into the room. Oh, Miss Wurster rented us the room. She said it's a semi-private bedroom. I say, what? Semi-private bedroom. Well, let's see. Well, I show you. And she come up. And say, here's the bedroom and here's the bedroom. And then I found out that she meant bedroom. She pronounced both alike, bathroom. So that was the semi-private bedroom or the semi-private bathroom, which we had to share with someone else. So then we had to meet another attic room, and then when the symphony season started and something became free downstairs, I think we went downstairs then and had two rooms. One room was combined kitchen, bathroom, with a screen in between, and the other was then a bedroom, and the kitchen had also a table. And I don't remember relative, the sister of that second cousin in New York came to visit us. And of course we had the blinds up high and there's some food on the table. And she said, pull the blinds down. They must only be half down. I say, why? Well, this is the way we do it. Everybody sees you are foreigners. So we had to pull the blinds half down. Then we offered her food. She said, don't you have any in the Frigidaire? I say, no, we didn't know that you put food in the Frigidaire. Well, I can't eat that. But those were, they were used to it, you know? Yeah. Your habits, it's not criticism. I just, you say your social life, so this was a part of our social life. Now, you better ask questions, so are we here still tomorrow?
Okay. I hated to break into any of this because it's been so interesting. It's been your background. I think we can speed things up now. Obviously, did not have any family vacations. I don't want to be presumptuous, but you were not vacationing at this time.
No.
Your religion, did you have any religious affiliation at this time? Did you join a temple or a synagogue?
We had no money to join anything. They gave us tickets for the high holidays for at that time a bit Israel, and we went there.
But you did go.
Oh, we did go, yes. And then I remember a funny thing about we went, well, sometimes, it has nothing to do with religious observance, we went by the Road of Sholem Temple. It must have been in May or June or something, and it's closed. I said, what do you mean? In summer, God is in Atlantic City? How can you close it? I don't know whether they have a chapel going or not. We were even affiliated with Road of Sholem for a short time. I think when the kids went to Sunday school there for a year or something like that. And then we moved, or because of that proximity, to Temple Sinai, also for Sunday school.
When did you leave South? How long did you live in South Atlantic Avenue?
Till we moved in with your parents.
And that was on Montclair Street, and that was 1940, I would say.
Ask your mother, I don't know.
No, I do, I remember.
It must have been
1940, or late 1939.
Yeah. And then, oh yeah, Ilse studied organ. And then she got an organ job at B'nai Israel Synagogue.
She did not play the clarinet at all.
Oh yes. She didn't. No, she had no use
for it. Not professionally.
No. She gave lessons. And she continued studying clarinet here with a member of the symphony.
And you gave, didn't you give violin lessons?
Oh, sure. It came out of my ears.
You did give private violin lessons?
Oh, yes. We did anything. We gave private lessons. We did anything to make a buck.
All right. Hobbies and...
We had no time for hobbies.
All right.
No money.
All right. What, could you give a very quick and a very... quick way of describing your neighborhood in the South Atlantic Avenue. Were there other people like you there?
There were a few symphony members there.
There were?
Yeah.
And what was the basic socioeconomic population of that area?
My wife maybe could tell you more about it. I never care who lives next door. Still today, I hardly knew their name.
Yeah.
Not that I'm snobbish or anything, but I don't put my nose in other people's affairs. And I'm not an enjoiner. So I didn't encounter anything unpleasant. It was a pleasant neighborhood. I loved the trees. And there were a couple of symphony men who lived there too. One even moved to our house downstairs, Wasserman, who was also a co-emigrant. Came later, I think. He was in a more difficult position because he never knew that he was Jewish. He knew he had a Jewish mother, but he never was Jewish.
And so he was...
So, we were Jews and we were helped by Jewish organizations. But the so-called non-Aryans, they didn't know where they belonged.
Yeah. Then, do you have any... Then your economic situation, I think, is self-explanatory. We won't go into that. And culturally, I think, is also self-explanatory. And politically, were you Democrat, Republican?
Whenever it came to, I don't know what year, we registered, of course, and registered Democratic. And it was under Mayor Lawrence, a Democratic government, city government. And that woman who took ours said, of course, all refugees are Democrats. And I would have liked to report that, because she worked under a democratic government, city government. She should not have the right to say things like that.
No. And this was during the Roosevelt era.
Organizations,
did you belong to any organizations, either voluntarily?
I sent you the whole thing, didn't you get it?
Yeah. Just organizations.
Look it up. I forgot.
And your community involvement was just...
I'm very interested in anything, and I did things for the Institute of the Blind, or wherever they asked me. And sometimes it was speaking to Kivanis and so on. Sometimes it was most of the time speaking. in educational fields and in advising youngsters whether they should go into music professionally or not, which came out of community organizations or sometimes a Catholic organization asked me to do it. I don't remember that all. If you want to supplement it from the data sheet, you can add it later.
The politics, we've covered war, depression, prohibition.
Yeah, I want to add one thing to politics. Now, we both register Democratic and usually vote Democratic. But that doesn't mean we really believe in you should vote for the best person, not for that party or the other party. And if we would ever have the choice to find the person we prefer happen to be a Republican, I wouldn't hesitate a moment to. In fact, we often broke our voting record, yeah, and voted for Republicans in one thing and for Democrats in another. No, thank you. Just no thank you meant I don't want another cigarette. I don't think it means politics.
The depression you spent in Europe?
Yeah.
We covered that. Prohibition, you weren't here?
No.
Can you add anything at all?
No, I don't think. I kind of like that, kind of statement of philosophy or what you see is happening or prognostication, anything. Something very personal statement.
Well, then let me think.
Before we get to the children.
Well, let's first get the family in.
All right.
And then I end up with a general. Please smoke another direction. I can't talk at all anymore.
I'm not going to smoke.
Oh, yeah, you go ahead.
No. You have. How about telling us about your children? How many
with
children?
With pleasure. With pleasure. I can even tell you my grandchildren. We have two children. The first one was unfortunately died 3 weeks after birth. So we have now, otherwise we would have three. We got Stevie in 45. Shall I tell you about him?
Yes, he's married. Yes, three.
Eventually he's married, yes. He went to the what's his Entsetzen? If you are aghast at something or displeasure is very mildly put of many of my religionists to St. Vincent Prep School. They both went to Falk School. Ilse Tree taught there, and we got a partial scholarship, so they both went to Falk School from what's before kindergarten?
Nursery school.
From nursery school on to kindergarten.
Through eighth grade.
Yeah, and by the time Stevie was ripe for junior high, what's eighth grade? Is that already junior high?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. At that time, I was already a professor at St. Vincent College. And they had a prep school, which had an excellent name, very strict, but very good scholastically. And I got Skivy up there. And speaking of aghast of my co-religious, it's not bad enough that you teach at the Catholic college, but your boy, they'll make a Catholic out of him, because they want nonsense. And I tell you, nobody even mentions their Catholicism. I was the only one who in the college, during college classes, outside of theology, of course, mentioned Catholicism. When I told them, in the development of all the arts, we don't know where we would be if the Catholic Church would not have, in the Middle Ages, picked up the tab for painting, sculpture, music, all the things. They were all fostered. And I told them, you as Catholic students should be especially part of that fact. So I was the only one. But none of those priests or laymen who taught at the college otherwise mentioned it. There were Jewish students, there were Protestant students. One became a Protestant minister, and never made a secret out of it that it was his goal, and nobody objected to it. He was had a very good bass voice, a baritone voice, and was a soloist on many occasions. So Stevie went up to prep school there, and now to make matters worse, he selected for his university Georgetown University, a Jesuit school, because they had a school for foreign service, and he was very interested in politics, political science, and so on and so forth, and history. That was his field. And he went also to graduate school at Georgetown University. And when he graduated, that was a time when there were no academic vacancies anymore, and they cut down everywhere. Nobody cared for an instructor in political science or history. So he got an offer at Portland State University in administration. He took it, and he's still there.
That's where he is, and mm-hmm. he has three children.
Yeah, in the meantime, they have three children, and they're all very happy. It's a very happy family, since they are both tall, Stevie and his wife. The children all will be giants.
And in growing up, Stevie... He helped you a little bit in with the opera, didn't he, in Seth?
Stevie? No.
He never helped in Seth?
No. Stevie was a good cartoonist, but in opera, once in Faust, which is, you know, a lengthy and dark opera, he was about 11 years. He was with Ilse in one of the boxes back there. And when the prelude for the last act began, orchestra alone, the dark house, he said, "Oh, not that again!" And you heard that in the whole auditorium. And Ilse could disappear. And behind her was sitting Mr. Saudek, who was a very well-known musical personality here in Pittsburgh, and his wife, Gardner, who had a women's show at KDKA. And Saudek was hard of hearing, and he said to his wife, What did he say?
And then you have a daughter.
And I have a daughter. My daughter also went to folk school. Then for folk school, she went to Winchester Thurston. And she studied piano with Ilse. And then had also very good teachers here, Mr. Truxell, Harry Franklin, Mr. Pollock at Duquesne. I mean, she took private lessons there. But when she came to Winchester Thurston, it's a very demanding school, and she actually had no time to practice anymore. And up to then, she played as soloist with the Pittsburgh Symphony in youth concerts and won quite a number of contests as pianist. And she's a born musician, a much better musician than I am.
And what is she doing now?
Oh, not so fast. You have to have patience now. You ask me about my children, I'll tell you about my children. So she went to Winchester Thurston, and graduated there, and now she always wanted to be a singer. She grew up, she is the one who grew up with opera. She was at every performance, at every dress rehearsal, and was the butterfly child for several years with several butterflies. And everywhere there was a children role in Bohème, she even sang, "Boy, that trumpet."
And she danced?
And she danced in Aida, the Moors. Moors?
Yeah.
And so on. But she really soaked it up, because that was her feeling. She wanted to be a singer. That was the greatest misfortune for her in her life, that she couldn't become a singer because she didn't have enough vocal talent. So she thought she takes the next best drama. She wanted to go to Tech, which was nationally acknowledged as a good drama school, and she was accepted. But then when she saw the curriculum, they had only one subject, English, of the liberal arts, nothing else, and she didn't want that. She wanted more liberal arts subjects. So she went to Boston University Drama School, which had more liberal arts subjects, which later she regretted very much, because it turned out that the liberal arts subjects she had there, she always had at Winchester Thurston. So... in her last year, in her senior year of drama school, she told her head of the department, "Please don't cast me anymore. I think I switch back to music after I graduate. I go through with my last year. I finish what I start." But so she said she couldn't do it, because If you get a role, 48 people hate you. If you don't get a role, you doubt yourself. She said, I couldn't live like that. And do the same thing then professionally, no. And it drew her back to music. So after she graduated, got her bachelor's degree in drama, she auditioned for the graduate school in piano, was immediately admitted for the master class, and had to cram one summer in all those prerequisites, undergraduate, which she all finished in during one summer, and then was in graduate school for 2 days and made her master's degree. In fact, to be exactly truthful, she left the school after she completed her academic requirements and concertized most of the time as accompanist, but also gave a few solo appearances in Boston, in Buffalo, I think, and then somewhere in New England, and with me in Greensburg, with concertos. And because she played one recital as the requirement for the master's degree. Then her dear co-student, that was the time of all the unrest at the universities, burned down the music department, or the auditorium building, with the grand pianos. And she couldn't give a second recital. So the next year she was supposed to play in a lounge with a miserable piano. She said, I don't play there. So, and she started concertizing. And now they said, we take her concertizing in lieu of the second recital, and she gets now on the 16th of May the official degree, a Master in Music, which she didn't care about. She poo-poos it, but we don't, because you never know in life what you might know one need one day. And since she went through all the studies and we went through all the paying for it, at least finish what you start. So she saw the point, and that's the trouble.
And what is she doing now?
Yeah. Now, she became unhappier and unhappier to the point of getting depressed. She said, I cannot do this life. Practicing in my four walls for 7 hours a day, which I have to, then go to some city, which I'm in, not interested, she's not interested in any cities like outside of New York, sit in a hotel room, go to a concert hall, go back to the hotel room, and on to another town. I'm not, what kind of life is that? I'm so isolated, I don't meet anybody, I can't live like this. So fortunately, she has some very good and sane friends, among them Nell Rankin and her husband, Dr. Davidson, who is a physician.
And Nell Rankin is with the Metropolitan.
Nell Rankin is with the Metropolitan. They are very, very close friends of Barbie. Nell told her, and we have known them for many years. So they told her, Barbie, with your wide background and your theater experience and your love for the theater and your pull back to the theater, why don't you go back to the theater as a stage director? Barbie said, who wants a girl as a stage director? She said, don't be ridiculous. Today, what about Sarah Caldwell? What about Volkman, who is at the Scala and other people? Today, women do everything. She said, all right, what shall I do? So she sent her portfolio in with everything to the National Opera Institute, which is a federal agency, under George London's supervision. And within 2 weeks, she got a notice, or I think George called her, and said, I sent your resume to Mr. Riedel of the New York Opera, and I arranged an interview for you, call him up. So she went to the interview, Riedel read her background and say, I don't know what to do with you. What are you? You're a pianist, you're an actress, you're a dancer, you're a stage director. What do you do first? What do you want to do? See, I want to do opera stage directing. Say, okay, see Mr. Pollock. Pollock? I think it's his name. I always mix it up. So, to make a long story short, She is now associate stage director at the City Opera in New York.
I think I'm going to go.